Hi, I'm David Fettis, and welcome to part two of our study of economy. How does capitalism work? Well, the economics of capitalism developed out of the interactions of five items: commodities, money, labor, means of production, and production. We'll see how each of those are defined by the sociology textbook. There are two types of commodities: capital goods and consumer goods. Capital goods are products not produced for immediate consumption, such as land, raw materials, tools, machines, factories. You're not consuming those. Those are capital goods because they're used to make stuff that you will be selling. But they serve as the raw materials for consumer goods: televisions, cars, computers, houses, and so on, that are going to be sold to others. So you have some stuff that is needed to produce goods that are going to be sold. And those are called capital goods, the production stuff, and the consumer goods is what you're actually selling. Money is a standardized means of exchange which serves to reduce all goods and commodities to a standard value. It eliminates the cumbersome system of barter by separating the transactions involved in the exchange of products, thus facilitating specialization in trade through encouraging the exchange of commodities. That's kind of a mouthful. You thought you knew what money was. Anyway, money is something that means you're not just trading a TV for a cow. You can use money to buy a cow, and then you can sell the cow for more and use that money to buy a TV. But money is the thing that allows you to deal with a whole lot of different things, but always using the same item, whatever the specialization of those things is. And that, of course, enables a whole system where stuff is widely moved around, but it's not specifically the cow for the TV. It's money for the TV, money for the cow, and whoever has the money then can go out and get something else with it. Labor includes all mental and physical human resources, including entrepreneurial capacity and management skills, which are needed to transform one type of commodity into another. So you have people actually working on the thing you're trying to transform. You're trying to transform, for example, sand or its components into silicon, and transforming that into computer chips, and changing that into phones and microwaves and what have you. And that takes people who do the actual work, that takes managerial people, that takes inventive people, entrepreneurial capacity, all kinds of things go into labor. Means of production. That means all manufacturing aids to production, such as tools, machinery, and buildings. So means of production is the equipment needed to make stuff. And production is the act of making goods or services through the combination of labor power and the means of production. So you've got a restaurant. The means of production might be the kitchen, the ovens, the tables, the chairs, the building, and so on. And then you've got the workers are the people in the kitchen and the servers and the people who clean up afterward, and then the person who manages the company that owns the restaurant and all of that. So you have that combo of labor with the means of production, the facilities of the restaurant. Individuals in an economy, they have a role. Sometimes you think of the economy as this big thing, this machine almost, but individuals are involved, individual people. Individuals engage in the economy as consumers who buy stuff, producers who make stuff, laborers who are working on stuff, investors who are putting money into making it possible and buying the equipment necessary and providing both money and labor power. For example, as consumers, individuals influence production patterns through their purchase decisions. If you won't buy it, they won't make it. As producers, we'll change production to produce what consumers want to buy. The customer is king in some sense, so you may feel powerless, but in fact, if lots and lots of people refuse to buy something, it's not going to get made. As laborers, individuals may decide which jobs to prepare for and in which markets to look for work. So you have a role as a consumer, you also have a role as a laborer. What kind of job do I want? What kind of area do I want to look for work? Investors decide how much of their income to save and how to invest their savings. So you've accumulated some extra money. what company do I want to invest that in? What mutual fund? What bank do I want to put it in? Do I want to just go out and buy a big flat screen TV or a new car? But investors say, well, I don't think I'm going to spend it all. I'm going to save some of it and then invest it in something else. And these savings, which become investments, provide much of the money that businesses need to grow. So you have consumers, you have workers, you have investors, and each have roles as individuals in the economy. And then beyond the individual level, business firms together decide what to produce and where this production should occur. So a team gets together and decides, okay, what are we going to make? Where are we going to have our factory? They also purchase capital goods to convert them into consumer goods. For example, if you're a bread company, you buy flour, you buy all the other stuff that goes into baking bread, you also buy the ovens and all the other equipment to make it, and so you've got to purchase that. And businesses also try to influence consumer purchase decisions through marketing, as well as the creation of new and improved products. So you can't just make it, you've got to let people know about it, so that they can buy it from you. You've got to let them know that your bread is the best, or that your TV is better than any other. And sometimes you just want to let people know about it where there's already a demand for it, and all you got to do is inform them that you've got what they're looking for. But most of the time, there's a competition for your business, so you also have to let them know that for some reason yours is a little better than somebody else's. And a good bit of influencing consumer purchasing is to get them to buy stuff they didn't know they need. Okay? A few decades ago, nobody needed a cell phone or a smartphone. Such things didn't exist, and they felt no need for it. Now everybody needs one. And not only do they need one, they better have a flagship phone. In many cases, they'd feel, so out of it if they just had one of the cheaper smartphones. They want top of the line because they've been persuaded through marketing, or maybe they did find that this is a super good phone, and the marketing is true. It works as advertised. I love this phone, and when I buy another one, I'm going to buy that same brand, only the newest and latest and greatest of it. But marketing is a big part of what business firms do, not just having a good product, but then selling it to people and making sure they know about it and making sure they want it. What drives the capitalist economy is the constant search for profits, revenues minus expenses. This need for profits, known as the profit motive, ensures that companies produce the goods and services that consumers desire and are able to buy. In short, you need to make money in order to stay in business. In order to make money, you have to sell most of your stuff for more than it costs to make it. If it costs you more to make it than you can get for it, you lose money. And if you do that long enough, you go out of business. In order to be successful, firms must sell at a certain quantity of their product at a price high enough to yield a profit. A business may consequently lose money if sales fall too low or costs are incurred that are too high. So if you can sell a million things, but it costs too much to make them, you're going to lose money. Or if you can only sell three things at a profit of $1 each, you're just not selling enough. So you both have to sell enough product, and you have to be able to charge enough for the product to make enough profit. So profit and prices are very closely related. And then there's the cost. The profit motive also encourages firms to operate efficiently by using their resources in the most productive manner. By using less materials or less labor or capital, a firm can cut its production costs, which can lead to increased profits. So if you've got workers and you give them the things they need to be really productive, then you're going to make more profit than if you're paying a bunch of workers but they don't have the right tools to be really productive in what they make. So you want to cut your costs as much as you can and still make a good product. And sometimes that hurts because sometimes it means cutting workers or firing people. But it's not always a bad thing to be trying to cut costs. You want to be efficient. You only want as many workers as it's going to take to make the products. And so that's how capitalism works. And workers who aren't needed here often can find employment somewhere else. The market is a term used by economists to describe a central exchange through which people are able to buy and sell goods and services. In a capitalist economy, the prices of goods and services are controlled mainly through supply and demand and competition. Those are three extremely important terms: supply, demand, competition. Supply is the amount of a good or service produced by a firm and available for sale. Demand is the amount that people are willing to buy at a specific price. Prices tend to rise when demand exceeds supply. When more people want it than there is available, prices go up. And prices go down when supply exceeds demand, when they're making more stuff than people want to buy. So the market is able to coordinate itself through pricing until a new equilibrium price and quantity is reached. Equilibrium is when the amount of supply and the amount of demand are roughly the same. And when demand increases, that'll increase price, and an increased price will then make the supply go up, because when people say, hey, there's more money to be made in this, they're going to make more of it. Competition arises when many producers try to sell the same or similar kinds of products to the same buyers. Competition is important in capitalist economies because it leads to innovation and more reasonable prices, as firms that charge lower prices or improve the quality of their product can take buyers away from competitors. That is, they increase their market share. So if one company is making a lousy smartphone and another company is making a great one and charging roughly the same price, who are you going to buy from? You're going to buy from the makers of the good one, and when you hear horrible reviews about the phones from the other one, that company is going to sell fewer and fewer. That's what's involved in competition. Or there's one restaurant that is infested with rats, where all the food is bad. And there's another clean restaurant with a great chef and wonderful servers and fantastic food. Well, which restaurant are you going to go to? Well, if you can afford the good one, that's where you're going to go. So when there's competition between restaurants, the better restaurant with fair pricing will usually do better than a really lousy restaurant, with even if the prices were good. So you need quality and price when you're competing with somebody. Without competition, a monopoly or cartel may develop. A monopoly occurs when a firm supplies the total output in the market. There's only one restaurant in town, and even if it's got a few rats, if you want to eat out, that's your only choice. Back when Ford was the major car company, Henry Ford said, customers can have any color of car they want as long as it's black. And when you're kind of a monopoly, you just make it, and there's no other game in town. They've got to buy from you if they're going to buy anywhere. When people needed oil back in the days when John D. Rockefeller and Standard Oil controlled the market, you were going to buy oil from him or you weren't going to get it. So a monopoly occurs when a firm supplies the total output in the market. And when this occurs, the firm can limit or control output and raise prices because it has no fear of competition. You could just keep raising the price of gas if you were Standard Oil, and people had to pay it if they wanted to run their cars. And if another company tried to get into business against Standard Oil, then he dropped the prices temporarily so that the other company couldn't make any money. And as soon as they were out of business, then jack the price again. A cartel is a group of firms that act together in a monopolistic manner to control output and raise prices. One example of this would be OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. They found that if all those countries collaborated together as a cartel, they could control the price of oil better than if they were all just in competition with each other, selling oil on the open market. So where there is monopoly, then there is the ability to control prices. Many countries have competition laws and antitrust laws that prohibit monopolies and cartels from forming. In many capitalist nations, public utilities, communications, the phone company, gas, electricity, etc., are able to operate as a monopoly, but they do so under government regulation due to high economies of scale. So the government says, well, we don't want 15 different companies supplying power. We'll just have one, but then we're going to set the price of how much they charge, and we're going to regulate exactly how they do things. So there are government-run monopolies of certain kinds of enterprises in various countries. When you speak of supply and demand, here's a graph that shows the supply and demand curves. The S curve is supply, and you find that when quantity goes up and price goes up, you see that curve. And then you see demand. The D1 curve would be demand under certain circumstances. When the price is way high, then Q, the quantity of demand, is very low. When price is really low, then the quantity of demand is really high. If you can get T-bone steak for $23 a pound, demand is pretty low. If you can get T-bone steak for 20 cents a pound, then the quantity of demand is very high. And so supply, the people who produce the steaks or the phones or whatever you're trying to sell, they don't want to supply far, far more than the demand will get, or they have to keep dropping prices to get rid of it. And you see where the blue line meets the red line, D1, that's where price and quantity have found an equilibrium. The suppliers can charge this price, and people will buy it at that price. Now, if demand goes up, then you get that's the D2 curve. If there's a higher level of demand for a certain product, then the suppliers will increase the amount they produce, and they'll also jack the price. And once they find the level at which they can get enough demand at the new price and the new amount of production, then that's ideal. They don't want to get their prices too high, because that will drop the demand. They don't want to get their quantity too high, because that will drop the price. So finding a kind of equilibrium between supply and demand, between price and quantity, is very important in any kind of competitive capitalist economy. A worker's income in a capitalist economy depends primarily on what skills are in demand and what skills are currently being supplied. If you're a great horseshoer, for instance, that would be a skill in high demand 150 years ago, and only a few people would do that now, because horses are not the primary means of transportation anymore. People who have skills that are in scarce supply are worth a lot more in the market and can attract higher incomes. If you are someone who can work with extremely complex equipment or do computer programming at a higher level than most people who don't have your intellectual abilities, you get paid a lot. If you're doing a job that's not too much work and very simple that almost anybody can do, you're not going to get paid a lot to do that, because just about anybody can do it. So when there are skills that are in scarce supply and there's demand for it, you're going to get paid more. Competition among employers for workers and among workers for jobs helps determine wage rates. Firms need to pay high enough wages to attract the appropriate workers. However, when jobs are scarce, workers may accept lower wages than when jobs are plentiful. So if you have 100 applicants for 3 jobs, you don't have to pay a super large amount if they're all qualified applicants. But if you have 10 openings and only 3 people applying, you start saying to yourself, man, I either got to advertise better and get more people to apply, or I'm going to have to raise the amount that I'm paying. If you're trying to hire computer programmers for the price that you would pay people to fry hamburgers, you're never going to get somebody to work for you, because other people are willing to pay those programmers a lot more than you're offering them. So firms have to pay enough to attract the kind of workers they want. When jobs are scarce, though, let's say there's a glut of computer programmers. There's just a whole bunch of people that major in math and computer, and there's tons of them, and they used to make a ton of money in that job, but now there's too many of them. Then they've got to say, well, I used to be able to make $150,000 a year. I'm going to have to work for $38,000, because that's all the employers are paying right now. So then you accept lower wages when jobs are plentiful. On the other hand, I mentioned the case of frying hamburgers, or a job such as doing landscaping, which involves a lot of heavy manual labor. Maybe a lot of people would prefer not to do that, but there's jobs in manual labor where if people aren't eager to do that, but other people are strong and willing to work hard, and there's a shortage of people willing to do that, then all of a sudden, working in a restaurant or flipping hamburgers becomes more valuable, and instead of getting $5 an hour, they can't get anybody to work for them at $5 an hour. So they bump it up to $7.50, they bump it up to $8, they bump it up to $10. Hey, we may have to pay $13 an hour. And so you find that in an economy where employment is pretty high, then employers have to pay more because it's not so easy to get the workers they need. Labor unions and government also influence wages in capitalist nations. So it's not just how many workers there are and how many positions the company has. A union can say, none of us are going to work for you unless you pay what we ask and unless you offer the working conditions that we want. So you might have an auto workers union that says, we're shutting down your factory. None of us are going to go to work unless you give us all a pay raise and a little more time off or whatever benefits, a little better insurance, what have you. And government also may set a minimum wage and says, hey, nobody in our country or nobody in our state or community works for less than this. Unions represent laborers in negotiations with employers over such things as wage rates and acceptable working conditions. And most countries set a minimum wage, and government agencies work to establish safety standards, because you don't want people dying from bad things on the job or extremely unsafe conditions. So unions and government have an influence that goes beyond just mere letting supply and demand run its course. Unemployment, according to this writer, is a necessary component of a capitalist economy to ensure an excessive pool of laborers. Without unemployed individuals in a capitalist economy, capitalists would be unable to exploit workers because workers could demand to be paid what they're worth. That's kind of a prejudicial way of putting it, because in an economy there has to be at least some employment or nobody will ever be able to move from one job to another. There would also be zero competition for wages, so people could say, hey, I'm not going to work unless you pay me $1,000 an hour. Well, that's not what they're worth. So, in a sense, there would be a monopoly on labor if there's nobody competing for your job. So just as a company needs competition in order to be at its best in producing products, so workers need at least a bit of competition in order to have incentive to do a good job and not to demand the moon when they're asking for wages or for benefits. So competition is needed both at the production end and at the hiring end, but at the making of products in order to make the best products. But there needs also to be some competition in the worker market, or workers are not naturally going to be driven to do their very best work. When people become unemployed, the longer it takes to find work, the lower their returning salaries will be when they return to work. This is an overall observation about economy. And so it is hard to be unemployed. And let's not underestimate that. Thus, not only do the unemployed help drive down the wages of those who are employed because they're competition, but they also suffer financially when they do return to the paid workforce. Now, again, this applies within certain limits or boundaries or parameters. When unemployment gets low enough, it's considered full employment, even when unemployment is 4 or 5%. And actually, wages begin to increase, not when there's zero unemployment, but when there's relatively low unemployment. So, and sometimes wages increase even when there's high unemployment, because a certain segment of the workforce might be unemployable by many firms because they lack the skills that those firms want. And so it may not be that the whole economy has vast unemployment, but that there are segments of the economy that somebody was trained for one kind of skill and had experience in that, and then demand for that was lost, and they can't find work at the wages they were accustomed to getting. At any rate, the human experience of unemployment is no fun at all for those who need it to make money, and for those who also get a sense of their dignity and value and importance from the things they accomplish in providing for their family and in doing useful things. And to have too much unemployment drives down wages and hurts everybody. In capitalist nations, the government allows for private property and individuals are allowed to work where they please. The government also generally permits firms to determine what wages they'll pay and what prices they'll charge for their products. That's within reason, of course, because there are often minimum wage laws that have to be met, but very often the minimum wage is far less than what many companies would have to pay their workers anyway. So then the minimum wage might be $7.50 or $10 an hour, and the company may have to pay $30 an hour or $40 an hour just to attract the kind of workers they want for that particular kind of work. But within those parameters, once they've met the minimum wage, once they've met various constraints, then they can pay what they want to their workers and they can charge what they want for their products. But, of course, the government might not limit what they can charge, but the consumers will limit what they can charge. If you want to charge $5 million for a cheap car, nobody will buy it. So the capitalism is largely limited by supply and demand and not by control of government, but government does have some role. The government also carries out some important economic functions. For instance, it issues money. It supervises public utilities, and it enforces private contracts. So companies that make a contract, it's between those two companies, but if they breach or break the contract, they can be in trouble with the government. Laws such as policy competition protect against competition and prohibit unfair business practices. So government can do certain things that limit competition in this area or that keep businesses from undercutting other businesses unfairly. And there's some question about how much of a role government should play in capitalism, but there's no question that it needs to play at least some role. Socialism, of course, would like a complete role to abolish capitalism and have government control everything. And some capitalists would like government to have almost no role. And the truth lies somewhere in between. Government agencies regulate the standards of service in many industries, such as airlines and broadcasting, as well as financing a wide range of programs. In addition, the government regulates the flow of capital and uses things such as the interest rate to control factors such as inflation and unemployment. So, let's say unemployment is getting real high. Then the government's central bank will often drop interest rates, which makes borrowing easier, and companies start hiring more and producing more stuff, and unemployment goes down. Then unemployment gets down to a certain level, and the central bankers say, uh-oh, if unemployment gets much lower, wages are going to go crazy and spike, and it's going to cause inflation, and so we've got to increase the interest rate to slow down the growth of the economy. So government does have a major role, even in largely capitalistic countries. Critics of capitalism say that capitalism leads to unfair distribution of wealth and power, that it tends toward market monopoly or oligopoly, government by oligarchy. Oligopoly means a few people control a vast amount of the money. 1% can control huge amounts of wealth. Imperialism, wars, is sometimes blamed on capitalism. Economic and cultural exploitation, repression of workers and trade unionists, social alienation, economic inequality, unemployment, economic instability. That's a pretty nasty list. So there's a lot of things to criticize about capitalism and how it handles wealth and power. The main question is there a system that does any of these things better? Because other things have been tried. But anyway, capitalism, it's good to have some criticism and say, well, sometimes this has happened, and if it's bad, we should do what we can to keep that from happening. Another criticism is that capitalism is irrational and that production and the direction of the economy are unplanned, and that creates inconsistencies and internal contradictions, and it should all be controlled through public policy. And some people want everything to be run by central planning. It would be so much more rational if we just planned at a central level of the government how much stuff gets made and who gets to buy it and what prices it's at, and if we regulated and controlled everything. But of course, that criticism neglects the fact that who in the world knows enough to be able to plan it well? Has government proven that it can plan the production of phones better than Apple can, for instance, to take just one example, or than the competition of various phone makers can? So the criticism that it's irrational, yeah, it's irrational in one sense that nobody's got it all figured out and totally controlled, but sometimes we have to look at the limits of our own rationality and realize that nobody has what it takes to plan the whole thing. Another criticism of capitalism comes from the angle of the environmental people who are concerned about what it does to the world around us. They've argued that capitalism requires continual economic growth and that it will inevitably deplete the limited natural resources of the earth and other broadly utilized resources. So there's a fear among environmentalists that if you're always growing the economy and if consumers are always wanting more, 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 that's just going to devour and deplete the limited resources of the earth. And capitalists will say, well, maybe there's a lot more resources than you realize. And capitalism has often manufactured stuff. For example, the components of a smartphone are worth almost nothing. Most of them, the natural resources in them are often very cheap. It's the human genius that goes into those things that gives them their value. And so they're not polluting the environment. Defending capitalism, a common response to some of this criticism is that capitalism leads to inequality is, well, yeah, it's unequal. Some people produce more than others. Some people make more money than others. But capitalism also leads to economic growth, and that economic growth helps everybody, or almost everybody, and generally improves standards of living, such as better availability of food, housing, clothing, health care. In many capitalist economies, people who are considered poor have their own smartphone, they have their own television. Their main problem is obesity because they have plenty to eat and more. They have many of the things that would have been considered fabulous luxuries for even kings living a few hundred years ago. So even though there are inequalities, even those who are at the lowest end of the scale economically still often have a lot to eat, a warm place to live, clothing to wear, and access to health care. And countries that have lacked solid business enterprises often are lacking in many of these other things as well. I'm not trying to say everything is good about capitalism or that poverty is fun in capitalist countries. But the point is that capitalist countries have a lot less poverty than socialist countries do. Also, capitalism has produced many environment-friendly innovations. People don't like pollution. Okay? And though companies may have done that for a while, the government put a limit on it, but so did consumers. They said, we don't want to breathe foul air. We don't want our streams, our rivers, our lakes to be full of sludge and crud. And so there was value in capitalism in producing stuff that minimized pollution. And you'll find that if you go to some of the more communistic countries, the pollution has been way worse and way higher than the pollution in the capitalist countries, because the innovation that occurred under capitalism produced factory methods that were a lot less polluting than government-run factories in some of the communist-dominated countries. So capitalism has its critics, but some of those criticisms can also be defended against. Nobody claims capitalism is perfect. The question is whether it's better than some of the alternatives.